If you want to go into the discussion in room 316 to continue the Battle of Lewisham discussion, please go through. They're assembling there. And this session will be starting soon.
And our second theme today is housing, homelessness and inequality. I suppose it's impossible to live in London now without having an understanding of the severity of the crisis facing housing and the degree of homelessness, visible and invisible, throughout the capital. We've got five speakers speaking on different aspects of housing and homelessness and inequality, describing different parts of the problem and looking at the possibility of different solutions in different areas. Our first speaker is Michael O'Keefe, who's going to be talking about Through the Roof, House Prices and Profiteers. Michael's a retired economist and non-executive director of Greenwich and Bexley Credit Union and co-chair of the Greenwich and Lewisham Positive Money Local Group. Michael.
Good morning. Still just morning. 10 minutes, not enough time to talk about anything in any great depth. So what I thought I'd try and do is just get over three points this morning. First is that we build too few houses. The second is that the banking system privileges investment in property over investment in productive, employment-creating uses of money. And the third is that the financial institutions become increasingly clever recently, well, recent decades, in creating means of changing the nature of our relationship with housing from one of shelter to one of investment, my pension pot, all of those sorts of notions. Okay. On housing numbers, the fact that supply doesn't meet demand. When Mark Carney took over as governor of the Bank of England, 2014, one of his early speeches just said how remarkable he found it that the number of houses being built in Britain was about half the number of houses that were being built in Canada, where he'd come from, despite the fact that we had twice the population. In 2004, Kate Barker, commissioned by Gordon Brown, had estimated a need to build houses in the UK in order for supply to match demand or come towards approach demand. Was somewhere between about 220,000 houses a year to 270,000 houses a year. In fact, last year in England, we built about fewer than 150,000. So we're just grossly under-supplying housing into the marketplace. On the other hand, demand is growing. June 2015 to June 2016, the population of England went up by 538,000. 538,000, over half a million. And we built fewer than 150,000 houses in that time. So we're undersupplying the market. And as a result, you've got all the pressures, particularly in London and the South East, of young people wishing to form a separate household, irrespective of tenure form, just don't have the opportunities to express their choices. The number of owner-occupiers over the last decade, that's 2006 to 2016, the number of owner-occupiers, people owning their own house, went down by about 250,000. The number of people in council houses went down by 500,000, approximately, and that's from a very low and shrinking number of council houses. The growth, 2.4 million people are now living, or more people are now living in rented accommodation. I mean, that's been the enormous change in the past decade or so. So, first message, anything that Philip Hammond does in the budget on the housing problem that adds to demand, such as waiving stamp duty or extra money for help to buy and all of that sort of thing, it's just adding fuel to the fire. The only sensible use of public money is that of increasing the supply of housing, whether that's in terms of finance or in terms of planning permission and all of that sort of thing. So that's the first message. Second is that we as a nation, we're viewed by our continental colleagues as sort of having a particular form of British disease, which is that we invest, in inverted commas, more of our national income in housing than they do. And yet, instead of it increasing the supply of housing in the UK, it's just pushing up the price of the existing stock. Now, you say, well, why is that? Well, partly there are issues about the supply of housing, which I talked about, but it's also about the supply of money into housing. It is the fact that the financial institutions, the banks, that provide housing finance, privilege investment in bricks and mortar and land over because that's security, that's something tangible they can get hold of. The alternative is to invest in a business, maybe, and you're then securing your loan against cash flow, future profitability, and so on. Much less tangible. So there's a skew in the system, and there's a skew also in the regulation. The regulators, the Basel rules and so on, actually privilege housing investment or property investment over other forms of investment. Sorry, to try and put some numbers on that, a bit old, 2010, but about 60% of British investment is actually in property, 8% is in providing the wherewithal for a business, so, you know, cranes or vans or software and computers and so on and so forth. So we've got this incredible skew of the way in which we invest. So when commentators talk about the productivity puzzle about Britain's economic performance, I think you have to look first and foremost at not how much we invest, but where we invest. Because I think that's the reason. Right, my third point is that dealing with the way in which, over recent decades, what we look for in property, in housing, has changed. The most important, most significant financial innovation there was the buy-to-let mortgage. That did not exist until 1996. Right? There's been a tremendous growth because of some clever people devising a means of removing investment in property that is intended for residential use as being viewed differently by the regulators and by the banks from that which is to buy the same sort of property but to turn it into a newsagent's or a hairdresser's or whatever. They're treated differently under the buy-to-let mortgage scheme. But also the other things that we're familiar with in London is the fact that we've become an area where people made a lot of money elsewhere in the world, in dollars or yen or whatever, want to park some safe money offshore to them, in London particularly. So we've become a magnet for that sort of footloose capital. The other financial innovations include things like mortgage equity withdrawal, which is simply telling people, realize the equity in your house, sort of have a cash drawdown against it. That's the sort of schemes that where people remortgage. They have a mortgage of 100,000. They remortgage, for 5 years. After 5 years, they remortgage for 120,000. They've still got the 100,000 that they're paying for the house, but they've got surplus over, and that becomes the new car, the holiday, and all of that. Way in which people use the added value that the banks have created by flooding the market with money to their advantage. So the upshot is really a warning that I would give. When you see that sort of financial innovation taking place, and also sort of government schemes, buy-to-let first-time buyer schemes and so on and so forth, be wary. There's a danger there, and America saw that in 2007-08. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Michael. Our next two speakers are talking about community-led housing, one from the national perspective and one from a very local perspective. They're both talking about community land trusts. And our first speaker on the topic is Beth Borman, who's communications and policy manager at the National Community Land Trust Network. It's the official charity supporting community land trusts in England and Wales, and there are currently 225 community land trusts nationwide. Beth.
Hello, hiya. So, thank you for having me here today. I'm here to kind of just be a part of the broader discussion of ideas of how we can actually help to mitigate this housing situation that's kind of going on at the moment. And as community-led housing is one option to this. We don't ever kind of say that it is the option, but it is certainly one option to what's going on. And it's already happening across the country, and people are having more power from it. So, as it was kind of suggested just then, there is so much to be frustrated about in the country and in London, particularly in London, where rent, as an average, is currently about £1,500 a month. Sale prices are £600,000. It's not uncommon in Broccoli for a family house to sell for over £1 million now. And this is in a borough where there are some of the poorest wards in the country. There's 9,000 people currently on the housing waiting list, 1,700 are homeless, and then there's obviously all the new developments that are coming up where there are some displacement going on as well. So it's pretty grim, and things do need to change. But it is changing, and I think it's really important to see that there is hope out there, and there are definitely communities that are embracing community-led housing and turning all of that frustration into some hope to actually help themselves and other people in their communities. So they're taking matters into their own hands, and by doing that, they're forming community land trusts. And that can be anyone. That doesn't have to be particular people in the community. It can be young, it can be old, it can be knowledgeable, it can be whatever. Like, anyone can form a community land trust. It's just about choosing change and doing it yourselves, really. So you're about to hear a fantastic example of a community land trust in Ladywell called RUS CLT. But in a nutshell, a community land trust is where a group of people form an organisation. They get a grant or a loan, or both normally. They buy land, they then build houses, and then they sell them at restricted prices, which means that it's genuinely affordable. And also the nice thing and the unique thing about community land trusts is that where that's then in perpetuity. So it's not just genuinely affordable for that one resident at that time, it's permanently affordable for every single resident after. I mean, this sounds pretty big to say, but community land trusts are changing lives. So a couple of years ago in Mile End, there's a family, Asha, who I know, and she was living in a two-bed flat. She just had a baby, and she was sharing that with her in-laws. She'd always lived in the area and wanted to be close to her family, but probably not that close, the room next door. But she just couldn't find anywhere to rent and certainly not buy in Mile End. So it was kind of, for her, it was pretty bleak. And when she was talking about it, it was just basically like she felt that was it for her in London. There was no way that she'd be able to stay and that she would just have to leave. And then one day, a flyer popped through her door from London Community Land Trust, which is the first community land trust in London. And she got involved, she was interested in that, and there's a huge community that's involved in London CLT. And this summer, she moved into her own two-bed flat. It cost £182,000, whereas the market value for a two-bed flat in Mile End is £450,000. So with London CLT, they work it out so that prices work on about a third of the average of the market value in that area. There are actually 240 CLTs at the moment in England and Wales. It's something that's gaining lots of popularity at the moment. It sounds a small number, but that figure has grown sixfold in the past 6 years. And thousands of communities are embracing that, from rural communities and now urban communities, which is really, really exciting. One of my favourites is, so in Brixton at the moment, there's a group called the Advocacy Academy, and they are sixth formers. And they are really, really worried about what's happening in Brixton and not being able to afford anywhere. And they've lived there all their lives. So they are literally parading through Lambeth looking for land that they can build, where they can form a CLT and build affordable houses on. They went to Lambeth Town Hall in September and kind of did a pitch for all these lands available and want more help and support with CRTs in their area. There's also the new Peckham Citizens Group that's just formed, and community land trusts are really, really high on their agenda, and they're looking to find a site in the next 12 months. London CRT is also doing its second project, and that's in Sydenham. So there is so much where you can get involved in an existing project. Or what I'd like to suggest today is that there is an opportunity. You can start your own community land trust, and hopefully Tony's talk will completely inspire you to do that anyway. But there's charities like ourselves at the National CRT Network who can help you out. There's also UK Co-Housing. And plus, just as I'll finish it really quickly, the Mayor of London has just invested £250,000 in the launch of a community housing hub. So from the new year, there'll be an actual place in London where you can go and speak to people and get technical support and advice and do your own thing. It's all about people power. So thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Beth. And to follow on from Beth, Tony Rich, who's vice chair of the RUS Community Land Trust that Beth referred to. Tony's lived in Lewisham for over 30 years, takes an active interest in local community projects. And for the past 4 years, he's volunteered with RUS Community Land Trust and since 2015 has been on the Board of Trustees. Tony.
Thank you. How are you doing? I'm using PowerPoint, so what could possibly go wrong?
Do you know how to start
a slideshow? Oh, no. I have very IT support. Anyway, it's the afternoon now, so hooray.
There we go.
As I say. I'm going to carry on from Beth. What are the slides doing?
Cool.
Yeah, and I'm talking about a local solution, so hopefully a positive story, as they say, a community land trust in Lewisham. Right, this isn't the American Midwest. This is Honor Oak Park in the 1980s. A group of residents getting together to build their own homes on council land. And here you go. Looks quite quaint. And the person who started Russ, Kareem Days, the guy who founded it, he grew up in one of these homes, and that inspired him to start his own project. But he was actually living at the time in Sanford Co-op, which is another pioneering project in Lewisham. Again, local residents and council land forming a co-op. And he was trying to respond to one of the questions that Michael was putting. You know, how can young people afford to live in Lewisham? And he had that problem. His solution was to start your own community land trust. And what is RUS? Well, it's an industrial provident society for community benefit, formed in 2009, and we're just starting our own project now, next year on site. So that shows you how long it's taken to get this far, and we hope the next site, the next project, will be a lot quicker. We're led by a membership, got over 750 members, and you can join for £1 for life. We're very pleased that we actually now got in for planning for our first site of 33 affordable homes in Ladywell, as Beth said. It's a co-housing development, so that means there's a community space within the scheme, so there'll be for meetings or for running sort of training, and that's for people living there, but also for the wider community. So if you like, it's the opposite of a gated community. That's the idea. There will be opportunities for not really self-build. I showed you a picture of people building their own homes, but this is, when I show you the pictures of this development, it's one building. So it's what you call self-finish or custom build. So people will be able to put their own kitchen in or do internal works or change the outside. And we're trying to build them all to passive house standards. I put high environmental standards there, and that's what we're aiming for. So ideally, the scheme will be producing more energy than it uses. So the actual scheme, it's 33 homes, some affordable rent, some shared ownership, some five will be for people on the waiting list. And that was part of the deal, if you like, with the council in return for the land. And I think what Beth was alluding to is the trust retains 20% of the property, so the land, if you like, stays in trust. So there's no right to buy, no one can own them outright. And we've pegged, in a similar way to Beth was talking about, we've pegged the rents and the equity to local earnings. And if you do your own self-finish, then it's cheaper. This is the site. You can just about see, you probably can't see it. It's in Ladywell, just north of Ladywell Road, and it has the River Ravensbourne around it. So it's a small cul-de-sac, so it has access problems. It's heavily... That's better. I thought we were all plunged in something. You can do that if you want, Claire. Yeah, I can see the button. And it's heavily polluted, and also it's liable to flooding. So there you go. So it's not a normal site. Yeah, I will keep going. This is the design on the site. Yeah, Wearside Depot's over the road, yeah. You know exactly where it is. So basically, the community space is the one with the tables there, really, and we're going to be growing food, or I won't be living there, but there's going to be food growing on the site as well. It's a no-car development. There's only spaces for accessible, you know, for disabled visitors or residents, plus one pool car, which people may use. This is another drawing of it, slightly faint. That's a better idea of it. So it's going to be very green in every sense, really, looking into the site with some of the planting. And that's looking out from the site. So people have been encouraged to grow plants and things within the development. I was asked to just go through some of the stages of how you might set up a community land trust or community housing project. We actually run a workshop on evenings or weekends, and I'll give you a link to that. But we run through these sort of stages. So firstly, forming the group. Beth alluded to this. I mean, we've got a sort of geographic group in Lewisham, but they can be community land trust can be group can be groups of interest. So, for example, there's an older women's co-housing project in Barnet called Ouch. What you need to do, we're all volunteers, as I think has been mentioned, so you need to find grants. We were greatly helped by the GLA and other people in actually keeping the thing running in the beginning. Finding site is a continual problem, perhaps the biggest issue, if you like. And certainly they're not easy sites to find. And one thing I have been doing is working on a neighbourhood plan in another part of Lewisham, Crofton Park. We've identified a site through that process for community-led housing. So there's different ways of doing it. But what we've asked for is a pipeline of public land which should be available to community land trusts, and we're going to be sort of lobbying for that in the London Mayor's housing strategy. How you allocate the homes is a really interesting thing. We've asked for a connection to the area, so people needed to have lived or worked in Lewisham for 2 out of the last 5 years. And then we just had an open ballot. So even Kareem, who started the project, wasn't guaranteed a place. He actually did get a place, but it's just through the ballot, really. The design team, you still have to employ fully professional teams, and you have to pay for them, obviously. So architects, planners, landscape architects, engineers and everything. We found a sympathetic architect called Archetype, who worked with Walter Siegel, the Swiss-born architect who started all the self-build projects in Lewisham. And what we've done is followed a co-design process. So basically, the residents have co-designed the properties with the architects. But that took longer, and it cost more money. So we've learned that as we've gone through. The 9 million or so we need to build the project is really lending. It's loans from ethical banks such as Triodos, and there's a lot more of those sort of opportunities now out there, I think, as Beth was alluding to, really. We've still got to negotiate through planning. We had to pay £7,000 in pre-application meeting fees with the council, and I think that's just a normal process. We've done a lot more engagement with the local community, so we basically have drop-in sessions where we've talked them through the plans. We've leafleted the area and we've knocked on doors and spoken to people. And you've just got to keep doing that, really. Just a final few things, our final slide, really. I think I was asked just to... All these slides, I'm sure, will be available on the website, but this is just some opportunities. If people are interested, there's a site called My Community Site where you can get grants for... I mean, it can be existing property. You could take over empty properties and turn them into community land trusts. You don't have to start building them. But there's grants available to start your project. You could join Russ, it's only £1, and we meet every first Wednesday of the month, basically. As I said, it's led by the members, and they can just sort of change people like me on the board if they want to. We run the workshops, the next one's in January, we've got the New Economics Foundation, where we run through the process about how you might start your group and what you need to do. The last thing, if people are interested in self or custom build, every local authority now has to maintain a register of people interested. It doesn't mean that they will be... Sorry, I've nearly finished. It doesn't mean that they will give you a site, but it gives an indication of demand. And that's all. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much indeed, Tony. Our next speaker is Councillor Damien Egan. Damien is Lewisham Council's cabinet member with responsibility for housing. He's been a Labour councillor for the Lewisham Central Ward since 2010, and he's Labour's candidate for Mayor of Lewisham in the elections coming up next year. He works for the Ethical Trading Initiative, which is an NGO. Damien.
Okay, well, I wanted to outline some of the key problems that we're finding around housing in our borough, but also talk carrying on from the positive theme of some of the positive ways that we've been able to tackle and mitigate against the housing crisis in our borough, but then also be frank and honest about some of the challenges that we have in the coming years as well. So I've been a councillor for 7 years, representing Lewisham Town Centre. I'm sure everybody knows Lewisham Town Centre, and it's an area where there's been massive change in terms of housing. And I think as a community, we really need to be thinking, has that changed, worked for us as a borough? And if not, as I'm seeing heads shake, how do we make development work for us? And I think there's some really important questions that we have to take forward together. But I've been leading on housing for 3 years. I went through homelessness in my teens with my mum and sister, so it's an area I feel very passionate about. And I've just moved in, so I'm 35 years old. I just moved into a place in May, and it's the first time I've ever lived on my own. And this is the reality of under 40s in our borough. And if I ask people to put their hands up if you're living in the private rented sector. So anyone living in the private rented sector, put your hands up. Very few people here, some. One third of people in our borough are living in the private rented sector. They're often the hardest people to reach. Most people under 40, particularly in Broccoli, was very, very high levels of people in PRS. We talked about average rent, so a two-bedroom flat, the average rent in Lewisham, £1,500 a month for a two-bed. So people are getting priced out of our borough. Something we haven't talked about is, well, what's the government's role in all of this? And in new housing development, the government cut the level of grant available to developers for genuinely affordable housing. It's one of the first acts of the coalition government, and they cut that by two-thirds. What that has meant is that affordable housing is few and far between. You also have to be very, very careful about what affordable housing, when developers talk about affordable housing, what that means, but I'll come on to that later. One of the other things that the government did, so we got that £1,500 is for a two-bedroom flat. Since 2010, they have frozen the amount. It's called the local housing allowance. It's as if you're on benefits, what you're allowed to claim. So £1,500 for a two-bed in Lewisham. Our local housing allowance is set at £1,148. So only 3% of properties are now coming into that LHA rate. And what is happening is that more and more people are being made homeless. I know Andrew from the 999 Club will talk about homelessness in our borough. Every single day in our town hall, we have families arriving with their suitcases because they have been kicked out by private landlords. That's the vast majority of reasons why people have been evicted, is because private landlords are putting up their rent. Most landlords themselves only own one, two, or three properties. So it's people within our community charging other people in our community extortionate rents and making them homeless. And there's a real piece of work to actually get landlords to understand what happens to those families, because it is not a pretty story. We have got families in hostel accommodation tonight, in emergency bed and breakfast. There are 500 of these families from our borough, and as we heard, it's now 1,900 families who are in temporary accommodation. So depressed everybody with those figures. But we are a council which takes our housing obligations rightly very seriously. I was actually talking at an event in Bromley yesterday. Bromley, can anyone guess what Bromley's target for the amount of council housing that they want to build over the next 4 years? John's got it right. It is zero. So in Lewisham, it's 500. And anyone who's been tracking that will know that the challenges of actually delivering 500 council homes across 40 sites and the challenge that we're having. But we will build 500 council homes, and we will build more council homes into the future. Everything will be sold. So we've already got 323. We'll take questions at the end, but we've got 323 already underway, and all 500 at least will be. The process of building will start by the spring. But it's something I'm always on to officers about, because we need to make sure we get these 500 homes. But on top of that, one of the things I've learned is actually how much quicker it is to buy homes off the open market. So next week, we will have bought our 100th home. We've got council officers in auction houses in our borough against the rogue landlords, against people who are profiteering, turning properties into HMOs, buying those properties, bringing them back into public ownership. Now, the thing to stomach from this is difficult, is these were often homes that were bought built with public subsidy, the original council houses, sold with right to buy at a discount, and now Lewisham were in a position where we're buying them back. But it's the right thing to do when we have so many people who are homeless in our borough. We've bought up nursing homes which aren't being used in the borough, some in Lee and one in Forest Hill, converting them into hostel accommodation. You'll hear about, and it's the same case in Lewisham, people who are homeless being placed outside of borough. We need more in-borough provision. Many homeless families are working, and they've got children in local schools. We need to keep people as close to home as possible. We've talked about community land trusts, and we are proud to support community land trusts. Lewisham had a radical housing tradition, which we've heard about, and what we want to do is resurrect that radical housing tradition. And one scheme that we're very proud of is our pop-up development for homeless families on the old Ladywell pool swimming site. So 24 high-quality homes delivered four homeless families, designed by Richard Rogers. He is doing another development with us in Deptford. It'll be a bigger development this time, all for homeless families, 100% affordable, and we're trying to secure £13 million from the GLA to build four more of these developments across the borough. Why do they work? Well, they work from a social perspective. These families are not in hostels, but also from a financial perspective. They're not paying rent to a private landlord, they're paying through benefits to the council, and so you get the saving each time. We get the rent, and we're not paying these rogue landlords either. I said I would talk about some of the challenges, and so thinking about we're not building, the first speaker, enough homes, and it's true, as a country, we're not building enough homes, as a capital, we're not building enough homes. But in Lewisham, we are. Like, in Lewisham, we are one of the top five builders of housing. Since I've been a councillor, always up there in the top five. Go to other councils, and that isn't the case. But the burden cannot lie just with Lewisham. Everywhere needs to be building, and we need Sadiq Khan, and we need the GLA to be a lot more forceful with those councils, particularly around the outskirts of London, who are not taking their obligations seriously. And also we have to think about, Lewisham cannot take that full burden, and what we want to do is also make sure that regeneration works for everyone. Now, Martin will be talking about a consultation around a regeneration scheme in New Cross on Achilles Street, and I think this raises some really important questions for us as a community. So we know we have this massive housing pressure. We know we have hundreds of homeless families. Where to build? So, we can talk about private development. We need to make sure that we're getting a better deal from private developers. That absolutely has to be a priority. But are there also estates where you can use the land in a different way? Obviously, possibly. And you could say that about every single development. But you have to make sure that there are cast iron guarantees in that. And it has to be, and this is a really important point, supported by the local community, not done to the local community. And, this will be a long and ongoing conversation to actually get something that's right and that most people can support. But I've been very clear with officers that my expectation is that people support development. And if people are not supporting development, then something has gone wrong. Land values are such in our borough that you should be able to make something work for everyone. I know that to do that, we need to build a relationship of trust, and there's plenty of examples that you may hear of councils doing it wrong, of moving people out of developments, placing them onto the other side of the borough. That cannot happen, that will not happen in Lewisham. That's not the kind of development that we want to see. And I think I really welcome coming here so that we can now start a conversation about Lewisham's next decade. What does that look like? Yes, we know we need more housing, but how does it work for all of us? Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Damien. Our next speaker is Andrew Mitchell, who's head of fundraising at the 999 Club. He's worked at the charity On Debt for Broadway since 2006, and in recent years it's gone through major change to focus its resources on helping people who experience homelessness, a growing problem. Andrew.
Thank you very much for inviting me here today. Thank you, the Broccoli Society. Thank you to Damien, who has come to the 999 Club on several occasions and brought the Housing Select Committee down. I used to be a student here 25 years ago, so it's great to be back in this building. I'm the head of fundraising, but my speech here today is just to tell you something about what we do and some of the issues that cause homelessness and the kind of issues that people who use our services actually face. So those of you who don't know us, we're down on the A2, just down in Deptford, on Deptford Broadway. And what we provide is a gateway service. And in the morning, for 1.5 hours, we invite in people who are having to sleep rough. They can get a shower, they can get breakfast, they can get laundry. They can just get a bit of respite from the streets. Last year, rough sleeping in London went up 7%. We're seeing about 20 to 25 people a day coming in the morning for that kind of support. After that, other people who are also homeless, we get people who are sofa surfing, they're sort of hidden. We get people who are vulnerably housed can come and come to our service. And they'll be sort of assessed and sort of guided towards the other services we do. So we provide advice and support. That's around people getting benefits, trying to prevent evictions, trying to find people housing, which is a great challenge and getting greater and greater. We have learning activities to try and give people the skills and the means to actually maybe find a job or raise their self-esteem. We have a night shelter. Again, we're building more seasons. We did 2 10-week seasons this year, and next year we're hoping to do 3 seasons, building up to 4 seasons by 2019. We have visiting health and wellbeing services through the NHS, through the Samaritans. We have TB screening, a podiatrist who comes in, and that people can try and access health. But that's health is quite an issue at the moment, and that kind of supply is actually getting worse. And then we also have employability support, because realistically, in this economic situation, work is the way that people may be able to find a home if they can find one which is affordable. So the challenges we face as this growth industry, which we shouldn't be in as a charity, is housing supply. It's getting worse. There's social housing has just diminished over the years. Affordable housing is not affordable, so I don't like that term. And as Damien's already said, most people face trying to get into the private rented sector if they can. And austerity has sort of also seen a whole lack of cuts to what's been happening locally. We've seen services being cut like anything. Welfare reforms causing people problems. Our advice and advocacy worker has won every of her ESA claims. So she goes to tribunals because people have been wrongly adjudged, and she's won every single claim. There is something terribly wrong with that. There is just general system failure. When people get released from prison, a lot of people aren't really helped. They're left on their own. It can take up to 2 weeks to get benefits, and I've received phone calls personally from people saying, look, if I can't get housed, I'm going to reoffend. If you don't get housed, the chances of reoffending are going up high, and what's that costing us? And the people we see probably don't have the best start anyway. I mean, we are all of us about 2 paychecks away from becoming homeless, but we see people have been brought up in poverty. A lot of people have poor education. They have lack of knowledge. So when their landlord says, I'm going to evict you, they go, okay then, and off they go, and they're evicted. They don't know. A lot of people don't know they've actually got rights. People have low confidence and self-esteem. They may not be opening those envelopes. They may not be dealing with those forms, which they find quite hard to fill out anyway. They have poor physical and mental health. With the cuts to the mental health services, we're actually becoming care in the community. We're not mental health experts, but we're seeing a lot of people with those issues. People have lack of skills and employment. They're often victims or perpetrators of crime. And they also have substance and alcohol misuse. Now, this is a term that people usually jump on with homelessness and say, oh, they're bringing it upon themselves. But honestly, if you were sleeping rough for a few days, you might actually be tempted to self-medicate. I don't know. So It's all quite depressing, isn't it? But I do want to leave you with some hope, and I want to tell you about someone called Josh, not his real name. But Josh came to us as a young person who was brought up in the care system. He came to us when he was 24. He came to us because he'd made 50 phone calls to various agencies to try and get housed when he found himself homeless and couldn't get anywhere. So he came into our night shelter, and we put him up in our night shelter. And whilst he was there, he joined in some of our activities, and one of those was to visit the Houses of Parliament, because pre-election, Vicky Foxcroft had promised that she would invite people who use our services to Parliament, and she kept her promise, so thank you. He also went to the mayoral hustings and joined in that and asked a question that why he, as a young person, wasn't given the same kind of support when he became homeless as when he couldn't get a job. He was told by university that he wasn't eligible to go to that university. This is a one in London. But our employability support person, homeless support team manager, actually worked with him. And the good news is, because Josh is quite angry, and to get rid of his anger, he wrote poetry. He got on a creative writing course at Ruskin College in Oxford. So we're no longer in contact with him. I hope he's still there, but that's the kind of turnaround we can make. So I want to thank you very much for spending the time to listen to me. If you want to hear more about us, we do have a newsletter sign-up form over by that stall, and I'll be joining the questions and answers afterwards. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew. And our final speaker on this theme is Martin Williams. He's an Achilles Street Stop and Listen campaigner. Residents and retailers of the Achilles Street area in New Cross are campaigning about a proposed redevelopment of the homes and businesses in the middle of New Cross. Martin's a long-term resident and member of the campaign. Martin.
Yeah, thank you. Let me just get my PowerPoint up. Okay, so, good afternoon, everyone. As Bartlett said, my name's Martin Williams, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the Achilles Stop and Listen campaign. So what I want to do is sort of talk a little bit about the campaign and the circumstances that gave rise to it, and then I want to use this to sort of perhaps highlight some broader issues in relation to housing and inequality, which is the sort of the theme of this session. So the Achilles Street area, I'm sure most of you know this, lies between Pagnell Street and Clifton Rise, and in fact was sort of the main focus of the Battle of Lewisham that you heard about earlier on. And for those of you who kind of aren't particularly, well, so for those of you who've never had your homes under threat of demolition, I think, and I hope that applies to all of you, in fact. What I want to do, really, is just let you know a little bit about the way in which the process works. So as with most things in life, it starts with a letter, and this letter will invite you to a consultation. And the letter's usually framed fairly innocuously, quite vaguely, you know. It's like, hey, we're looking to improve your area and build new homes. And so usually the first consultation is rather touchy-feely, and it will entail filling in a lot of post-it notes. But then maybe a few months after that, sort of the intentions will start to become a bit clearer. So the second consultation then sort of gave us an insight into what was really going on and what was really being planned for our local community and our local area. And the intention was essentially to flatten it and in its place build a high-rise and sort of high-density housing complex. So this kind of continued. There are a number of consultations, four in total, and it sort of brings us to sort of where we are now. Now, the only thing that changed throughout this consultation process was that the blocks got a bit higher, all right, and the tallest block got relocated from the Pagnell Street side of the area to the sort of Clifton Rise side of the area. And I think what really this does in many ways is sort of shed a little bit of light about what the council was really interested in, because this was all that happened, really. The council was primarily interested in demolishing the area and building high-density, high-rise housing complex. And obviously, as sort of as residents and businesses, etc., that wasn't our primary concern at all, really. Our primary concern was, of course, well, our homes are going to get demolished, livelihoods are going to be sort of destroyed, and the local community would just essentially disappear. So on the back of that, then, we set up a campaign, and we've been doing various things. We've had sort of resident-led meetings. We've had petitions, campaign tables. We've lobbied councillors. We've even sort of had our own fanzine, which is sort of like has sort of gone down very well in the sort of campaign communities across London. So what I'd like to do, and I think what this for me has highlighted, well, it's highlighted a number of issues, really. I mean, we can talk about gentrification, we can sort of talk about social cleansing, we can talk about actually about the redistribution of income and wealth from the many to the few, if you like, because this is what these processes sort of entail. But it's sort of the two, well, the one point I'd like to make and two sub-points would be about the neglect of council and social housing, I think, in London specifically, but across the country more generally. And a number of the speakers have already spoken about this. So what struck me about the process, and because we've done a lot of networking on sort of like Twitter and social media with other campaigns, is that sort of is the sort of like demolition seems to be the first option that councils of all political creeds, especially across London, have taken. So, and this has been our own experience, essentially. We've been presented with no other option other than demolition. And we've asked for other options such as refurbishment and infill to be considered, and they just haven't been. So no resources have been committed to sort of like developing other kinds of options, which are cheaper and sort of more environmentally and sort of socially sort of a friendlier way to go about redevelopment. The other thing that I'd sort of like to sort of mention, really, is about managed decline. Now, this is a term that sort of that I hadn't heard of until I'd sort of been involved in the campaign. But what it refers to is this sort of like this idea that sort of the running down, if you like, of council homes and sort of social housing. It sort of it relates to sort of an underinvestment. And this is something that's that we've come across that's very, very common to all of the sort of like the sort of neighbourhoods in London that have been redeveloped and or demolished or in the process of that happening to them. And the Architects for Social Housing estimate that at the moment, or well, at the moment there's about 200 or so and counting estates across Greater London that have been subjected to this. But anyway, sort of the idea of managed decline is this notion that sort of like landlords sort of neglect or fail to maintain sort of the buildings. And I kind of noticed this on Achilles Street, interestingly. So what we're finding is that because repairs haven't been done and maintenance hasn't been sort of perhaps as rigorous or as good as it should be, sort of the buildings are looking a little bit worse for wear. And what's interesting is that in our consultations, is that the council are actually putting this up as a reason or a justification for demolition. So, in effect, they're using their own failings as a landlord to sort of justify the demolition of our homes, businesses, and the local community. And this is very common to other campaigns. And actually, one of the other campaigns sort of put us onto a sort of freedom of information request, really, saying what you need to do is find out, well, how much income did the council get from these sort of the blocks and the business rent, and how much do they actually spend on it? And so we thought, yeah, that would be a good idea. So we put a freedom of information request in, and sort of these are the results, essentially. So what with this was over a period of 6 years for the Achilles Street area, and so the council got, in terms of income from rent and service charges, it was sort of like 2,600,000, and the amount of expenditure on the buildings was comparatively paltry 200,038. This was over a period of 6 years. So, in fact, what this generated was a surplus of well over £2 million. Now, yeah, profit, if you like. So if... can we take sort of questions later? Yeah, so it's 10%, but So if you kind of like extrapolate this across Lewisham and in terms of sort of the housing, then what you're going to find really is that sort of like the actual council housing, social housing, is going to be kind of quite a cash cow for Lewisham, and sort of perhaps it begs the question as to why, in fact, sort of there has been this managed decline, why people don't invest in sort of social and council housing anymore. But anyway, the final thought for the day would be that. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Martin. That's the end of the talks. We have time for maybe two or three questions. But like the previous theme, we can adjourn, and the panel will and I will, to another room, which actually will be 311, which is that way, which we need to use because the discussion about the Battle of Lewisham is continuing in the other room, I think. Time for a couple of questions, and then I think Claire will make an announcement about lunch and things. We've got someone with their hand up at the back there, please, and someone over here. And Greg.
Hello. So I have a question for the man from Achilles. The man from Achilles and the Lewisham councillor. Can you tell me what your relationship is? Because you're from Lewisham Council and you're in housing and you are in Achilles and you're trying to stop Lewisham Council demolishing your housing area. So what's the connection between the two? And is there a joined up Lewisham policy as Lewisham Council policy on regeneration, and why are you building these four blocks that the local residents don't want? What's the policy for Lewisham? And the second question, sorry, is just a general one. How does Lewisham Council think about the impact of Goldsmiths College on the local housing demand? Because Goldsmiths, I'm a native Broccoli person, and I've seen Goldsmiths College double in size, and so you have double the amount of students, and they're putting more pressure on Lewisham Council housing. Do you take that into account when you think about the housing demand going forward as well? Because a lot of the students will stay because it's relatively cheap, Broccoli versus other. So those are the two questions I have.
Okay. Thanks very much. We'll take two more questions and then answer them all at once. We've got someone over here, yes, who... Yeah.
So who are you pointing at?
Woman with the purple hat. If that's the right colour.
Thank you. This is for you again, Mr. Egan. you mentioned affordable housing. I think that was a Boris title myself, I'm not sure. But affordable housing for who? That's one question. And the other thing you mentioned about people buying houses and then renting them for big rents. Well, any council house now, or council property, social housing property, that anyone moves out of, it's becoming affordable housing. So it's the same thing what the private landlords are doing, is renting for an astronomical fee, but the affordable housing that now, anyone who moves out, as I said, of social housing, it then becomes affordable housing. So they're doing the same thing. It's just another name.
Okay, thank you very much.
And I can't see why private rent landlords are really charging a lot of money when actually council's doing the same with the affordable. And I'd like your take on that, please.
Thank you. We've only time for one more, I think. I'm sorry.
Very short.
Very short? Very short.
While the mic goes over. You take the mic to that person, I'll ask my question.
Okay.
Damien makes a very good case, but it's really not all his fault. He may have been cabinet member for housing for the last 3.5 years, but he has no power. Only Steve Bullock has the power. If you want to talk to me during the break about signing the petition to abolish the mayoral system, do so.
Thank you. Yeah, one more hand up there, and that will be it.
I was a part of the campaign which was opposed to the Lewisham Gateway and was opposed to the Loampit Vale development. We warned the council it was uncommercial. We warned the council there wasn't enough affordable housing. We warned the council about the environmental effects. We warned the council there weren't enough schools, there wasn't enough medical provision. We were not listened to. And now that place has become empty. It's an empty site at the moment, a large part of it. And I don't know what's going to happen to it. But my point is this. The answer to the question of why do the council do this is because I believe they're in the pockets of the developers. They dare not do anything else but in case the developers sue them.
OK, we've got several questions there, with most of which is going to need to be continued at greater leisure in a different room, I think. But maybe quick responses from Damien and Martin on their relationship, and then whoever would like to take a question on affordability.
No, well, I think what the presentation around Achilles Street shows is quite rightly, if anybody's home is under threat, which, you know, we can't gloss this up, this is for the council. The pressure is we need to build more council and more social housing. And that is what that development would be. And the council's aim is putting forward an idea of building more council housing and building more affordable housing for people in the private rented sector. I'll come on to the affordable housing point. But as I went back to the beginning, it's a conversation. And one of the things, you know, it's in one way, it's sad that you know, the first letter came out, what, 18 months ago? And so it's a long process of having that conversation with residents. Obviously, any of us, if we got a letter like that, we'd be like, what the hell's going on? But it's part of that conversation to see if something can work. And I feel very strongly that, and one of the reasons it's taking longer, no proposals have come forward yet. They will do. But it's to challenge our officers to actually make a case that protects everyone who's a council tenant so that they can stay on the development on the same terms, to protect every leaseholder that they still have home ownership options, to protect every private tenant there, protect businesses, and have more council homes and more housing for our homeless families. But at the end of it, if residents are still against it, and there are residents who will have different views, and I know it won't be one way or the other, completely 100%. But if there's still a general consensus against it, then I don't think development can go ahead. We can't have, and other councils have done this, I don't think that's the way we should be building in Lewisham. We have to be building for and with the community so that everybody feels they have a stake. So, yes, I understand. And this is really useful, and I can go back, I'll check those figures, find out how out of kilter it is, because, you know, council housing does make a profit. People talk about social housing as if it's some kind of subsidy handed down. Council housing makes a profit. That's why we should invest in more of it. So actually that makes the case for more council housing. I feel very strongly about that. Affordable housing, lady, you're completely right, because developers, that there's a development going on being proposed by Mayor Holmes for a 32-storey block on the old Tesco car park. And I sat in a meeting with them and they were like, oh, it's, you know, it's 18% affordable housing. I'm like, how is this happening all of the time? And developers do, you know, If councillors were in the pocket of developers, they'd probably live a lot more lavish lifestyles. But the thing, and I had to sit there with a calculator and explain to them, actually, no, what you're saying isn't affordable. The government, you're right, changed the term. So a decade ago when we were talking about affordable housing, that would have been housing people could move into. You're right, it's not anymore. We've got to be really careful about our language. We're talking about social housing, social rents. Sadiq Khan has said that should be, you know, no more than a third of somebody's income, which is the historical norm that people pay on housing. Now people are paying 50, 60%. What the government call affordable housing is 20% off, which if your home's 600 grand, which is the maximum, it can be like what's it, 480. Like, this is not affordable housing at all. So you're absolutely right. With this particular development, I had to go through, well, this is affordable housing. It was 4.1% was what we would classify as affordable housing. There was one point about Goldsmiths, and yes, the impact on, that will have a huge impact on the private rented sector. Actually, as part of that Achilles development, there would be more student accommodation too, and there's more student accommodation going in the borough, but you're absolutely right. But this isn't an issue of a lack of demand across all sectors. So, you know, this is driving up the cost of homes, but also then homes being stripped down in size and people paying more. So, you know, but we're very aware of the problem, and that's why we need to have a better, more regulated private rented sector.
Thanks, Martin. Would you like to just respond briefly, and then other panel members, if you have anything to say on affordability particularly?
I think in terms of like the conversation, I think from the slides that I showed, there has been no conversation. In fact, this sort of the plans or for the redevelopment have just been sort of imposed on the residents and the local community. So there hasn't really been a conversation, which is why we've sort of instigated the campaign in the first place. And the idea that sort of that this is, you know, sort of like going to increase the supply of social housing and council housing. Well, it's kind of ironic that you're having to demolish sort of council housing to sort of increase the supply of it. I find that bizarre to start with. But secondly, a development that size will require private property developers to be involved in terms of funding. And the minute that they get involved, as with the lady over there mentioned in terms of Lewisham Gateway, what will happen is that they'll stick in viability assessments. The number of social or affordable housing will get managed down and down and down, and Lewisham Gateway is a classic example of that, where phases 1 and 2 were supposed to have 20% affordable housing. It ended up with none, and this was after the developers were given the land by Lewisham, and they had grants from, well, 2 million from Lewisham Council and another 20 million from the sort of the Greater London Authority. So essentially, this is what I mentioned earlier, this is a big transfer of sort of income from sort of like the people of Lewisham, if you like, to sort of private property developers. And so really, until there is a genuine conversation and there are some genuine options, then I suspect my relationship to sort of Councillor Egan here will be sort of an antagonistic one, I'm afraid to say. Okay.
Thanks very much. I think we need to stop at that point. Anyone who wants to continue, get your lunch and join us in room 311. Thank you. I think Claire has a couple of announcements.
Right. Thank you. While you're all milling around, just to clarify what the lunch arrangements are, you need to buy a blue or a yellow, a green or a yellow ticket for soup or sandwiches, which are available there. That's for speed. And if people are going into room 311, they should be given priority. But during this lunch break, it's your chance to look at these displays on the wall and around and about.
And cinema at one, starting at 1
and
o'clock.
I particularly want to draw your attention to the fact that the films, the audio room, will start at 1 o'clock. Those are very worthwhile parts of today's events. And the first one at 1 o'clock is the audio recording of an interview with Sybil Phoenix, who is 90 and therefore has obviously not been invited to speak here today. But her son, Woodrow Phoenix, will be there to answer questions. It's a very interesting audio recording. And then there are other films afterwards, which are integral parts of today. Everything that goes on in this hall will be on the website. So what you miss in here, you'll be able to listen to on the website. I want to say one more thing, when nobody's listening. One more thing I want to say. Can I just... Sorry, this is very important. We run this as a free event, which means Broccoli Society is financing this event because we don't want to exclude people who can't afford to pay for these events. But we have two buckets for donations, one over there and one on the tea table. Please, will you donate what you think it's worth? If you're used to going to conferences where you pay £25, please put in £25. If you can't afford that, put in what you can. But please think about it, because it costs a lot of money and we want to keep it free. So pay us what you think today is worth, and we'll be rattling the buckets on the way out, but do it now and go and enjoy your lunch. Buy the photos as well.